Now we're going to begin the second conference, and here we're going to deal with the extraordinary manifestations in the person of sixth dwelling that are visible. There are some that are not visible, but others are. So we're going to still deal with those that are visible. And under this heading, we include stigmata, levitations, ecstasies, and revelations from God. Now, when it comes to authenticating whether these phenomena are of God or the devil or natural causes, the problem is very complex, and we do not wish to enter into this subject here except to point out the difficulty. A recent case for such study was Teresa Neumann of Corners Ruth, the stigmatist. Only a few years ago, there was also the very holy Padre Pio, universally respected by clergy and people. Today, we have Father Gino, also a stigmatist. Now, since the time of St. Francis of Assisi, also a stigmatist, we have had 321 cases of stigmata. The major part of these cannot stand up against investigation because they are false. Some cases have been submitted to scientific investigation. The stigmata of St. Gemma Galgani died the early part of this century at the age of 21. And Teresa Neumann, also Padre Pio. Now, how is the stigmata produced? If it is a true stigmata, that is, of God, there are two ways that it could possibly be done. First, by direct action of God on the body of the person, or by God's action on the soul, creating a wound of love of such intensity that it has physical effects on the body too, in the wounds of Christ. Now, according to St. John of the Cross, an exterior stigmata is produced by an interior stigmata. He writes, "It is quite different when the affection of feeling overflows from spirit into sense. For as St. Paul says, there may be much spirituality. For when the intensity of his realization of the sufferings of Christ was so great that it overflowed into the body, he writes to the Galatians, saying, I bear in my body the marks of my Lord Jesus." Now, we're not absolutely sure that he had the stigmata, but those words would point to something like that. Now, other external manifestations along with mental problems. Here, we're talking about the psychological signs of the dark night and the psychic manifestations of mental sicknesses. A person going through the dark night will register a similar reaction to God's action within the soul as someone else might register to some psychopathological cause. Both of them may have this bring about the same manifestation. But in both cases, the cause of the disturbance will be different. And to a certain extent, some pathological tendencies, a consequence, say, of original sin, exist in most people in varying degrees, in a mild degree in most people. For example, phobias, fears, anxieties, negative attitude, being scrupulous, being melancholic. They modify and control our life to some extent, like a fear of airplanes restricts the ability of a person to travel, or even fear of automobiles would restrict travel even more and so prevent many happy encounters with loved ones, friends, relatives, and even their attending spiritual occasions that might bring great blessings to them. Some of us are conscious of these tendencies, and others are hidden from us. But in the dark night of the spirit, our soul becomes painfully aware of these deep-rooted tendencies. St. John of the Cross speaks of them in these words, "This divine purification is removing all the evil and vicious humors, by humors he means these tendencies, which the soul has never perceived because they have been so deeply rooted and grounded in it, unquote. Now the word humors would refer to these pathological tendencies of our nature, the bond that they place over our our personality and habits is finally broken during the dark night of the spirit. Now the question of discerning the different phenomena. Generally speaking, we can discern the difference between problems that come from the dark night and those from psychic disturbances. St. John of the Cross has given us the signs for determining whether a person is in the dark night or not. And they are, 1. A person finds no satisfaction or consolation in one's prayer, good works, or other exercises relating to God, nor in any secular affairs or worldly things. 2. The memory ordinarily turns to God solicitously and with painful care, and the soul thinks it is not serving God but turning away from Him. And 3, in spite of one's efforts, there is an inability to meditate or make use of one's imagination, as was their custom. Now, in cases where both phenomena are mixed in the same person, in other words, things of God due to God's doing and others just due to their human nature, discernment of that is more difficult. To what extent one or the other is responsible for the behavior of the person will require a fairly long period of time to evaluate the general conduct of the person, and then to determine if the dark night is the predominant cause of the pathological tendencies or not. An author whom I am using rather extensively is Father Eugene Marie. In his book, I Am a Daughter of the Church, writes about this problem. He says, as long as genuine signs of the dark night appear, one should not treat the subject as an ordinary sick person. The spiritual director should take the lead in this case, for normally the pathological tendency will yield under the action of the dark night and disappear. St. John, when writing about the effect of melancholy in temptations against chastity, says, when these impurities attack such souls through the medium of melancholy, they are not as a rule freed from them until they have been cured of that kind of humor tendency, unless the dark night has entered the soul and rids them of all impurities one after the other. Now, when gold or silver, say, is melted to a liquid, all the impurities come to the surface. So in the dark night of the spirit, the evil tendencies within a person come to the surface and they are removed. So the soul is then brought into a moral purification as well as an emotional purification and freed from their pathological tendencies. This means the soul moves into a great freedom of spirit and a perfect emotional mental balance. That's why we can say after the dark night, they are the most emotionally mature people in the world. It might be good here to mention the advice of St. John of the Cross that a person, when they're assured that he or she is moving to union with God in the dark night, they should not become involved in pathological tendencies that may appear by great introspection. Rather, they should be recollected in God as much as possible by aspirations and persevere in that kind of recollection. What about a case of complete insanity? Suppose there is seemingly a paralysis of intellectual, moral, and spiritual life in a person because of insanity. Can we say that all intellectual life and spiritual life is at an end? No one can say with any amount of certainty that that is true. because we do not know what goes on within the inner consciousness of such a person. Externally, there may be signs of insanity, but interiorly, there may be signs of a lucid mind and a high interior moral life. Take the case of someone who has come to a state of brain damage that has immobilized intellectual life. Even then, such a person may have accepted it in advance. In advance of the trial of such a state as a purifying state, and to accept it as a redemptive trial. Take the father of St. Teresa Little Flower. Monsignor Martin had a complete paralysis affecting even his mental faculties. A French Franciscan, Père Piat, wrote about him in this state. He himself will keep for a long time enough lucidity to sanctify the bitterness of this annihilation of personality, while his daughters will find in it the principal trial destined to urge them forward on the royal road of the cross. And Therese speaks specifically of that, how it tried her. Also the case of a Carmelite whom I knew, who was a paritas at the Vatican Council. His name was Father Ziberta, Spanish Carmelite. He was brilliant. At the age of 80, he reverted to becoming a little child. He lost the use of all the great knowledge he acquired over all those years. He had a phenomenal memory. When he taught theology in Rome, he would say, "You will find a confirmation of this in Thomas Aquinas, page 185, footnote 3a. And a number of the students just to test him did that, and they found it to be exact. Yet there were periods of lucidity in his life. Also, a great Dominican theologian, Father Garrigou Lagrange, at the age of 80, also became a little child. Now, Father Ziberta was asked if he knew what had happened to him, and he said yes. And if he accepted it, and he said yes. So we cannot expect to find holiness always at the height of human perfection and perfect emotional balance and maturity. We may be surprised who's up in heaven. A French Jesuit, a great spiritual writer, Father Daguibert, wrote about just something like that. He said, "For God, there's no difference among the souls created and redeemed by Him. The soul of the poor hysterical patient, a real human tatter, going from clinic to clinic for years, is no less dear to him than that of the great scientist who studies that case. God will at times have recourse to his great means of sanctification, leaving perhaps untouched the heavy yoke upon this soul, but causing to spring up in its depth a true great love infused by him. There is a holiness, the sight of which, no doubt, singularly astounds us when the chrysalis will have become a butterfly, the sight of which he reserves to himself in this world." In other words, under cover of insanity, that's the cocoon. Within the spirit of that person, there's holiness. When the cocoon is gone at death, their holiness will be revealed in heaven. Now, the different circumstances surrounding the dark night. After this description of the dark night of the spirit, many spiritual persons might say that they would hope that there were some other way to attain sanctity than through so much suffering. No one can give a precise answer to this problem. When we talk about holiness, we are in the realm of God's plans for each of us, and this is a mystery to some extent. God's plan for each of us is worked out with great, infinite love and wisdom, mercy, and patience. Some of the circumstances surrounding the achievement of that holiness can be observed. For example, in the lives of the saints, We must remember that even St. John of the Cross says that all the trials and sufferings he describes will not happen to any one person, even half of them. Nor can he or anyone measure the intensity or mildness of these trials. Also, we do not know how many particular trials will be endured at particular time, nor how long. There are a number of factors here that should be taken into consideration before we take a negative attitude about the purification of the dark night. One of them is the intervals of freedom from trial. We must not think that a person in the dark night of the spirit is constantly in the fire of purification and that there is no relief. St. John writes, "The soul never remains in the same state for long, but is ascending and descending continually." The reason is that as the state of perfection, which consists in the perfect love of God and contempt for self, cannot exist unless it have these two parts, which are the knowledge of God and the knowledge of oneself, the soul must be practiced first in the one and then in the other, now being given taste of one, that is, exaltation, God, and now being made to experience the other, humiliation. So, according to the mystical doctor, there is a lessening of the intensity of the purification when the flame of love within the soul is burning less. That means the intensity isn't that great. At such a time, the soul feels the fire of love more in a consoling way. But then there's less of a purification, and so it is less painful. The reason for this is well explained by the Carmelite St. John. He says, "This enkindling of love is not always felt by the soul, but only at times when contemplation assails it less vehemently, or then it has occasion to see and even to enjoy the work which is being wrought in it, and is then revealed to it." Notice that God reveals it to them, what he's doing, not everything. He explains that it's like the iron worker who takes the hot red iron out of the fire to see how work has been done. But when he does that, the fire is not acting on the iron at that time. So, it's not that burning. Now, this kind of interval is a happy time of revelation to the soul of the God, of the one in whom God is working. It is very encouraging and a great support to go on. As to how long it will last, no one can say. With some souls the Lord does a quick work, with others it takes a long time. Again, there may be long intervals between purifications. With some may not be completed in this life, perhaps with many. Why, only God himself knows. Sometimes the Lord does not purify a soul of a certain bad tendency for a very long time, perhaps to keep that person very humble, because they're not quite ready for that, or for some other unknown reason. Secondly, there is a specific kind of purification. The one who purifies the soul is the Holy Spirit, for he is the flame of divine love. So the intensity of the flame that purifies the soul is measured according to the particular kind of holiness that is to be produced in that individual soul. Now here's what the mystical doctor writes. All do not experience it, namely the purification, after the same manner. Neither do all encounter the same temptations. For this is meted out by the will of God in conformity with a greater or smaller degree of imperfection which each soul has to purge away. In conformity also with the degree of love of union to which God is pleased to raise it, he will humble it with greater or less intensity, or in greater or less time. Those who have the disposition and greater strength to suffer, he purges with greater intensity and more quickly. But those who are very weak are kept for a long time in this night, and these he purifies very gently and with slight temptations. So the sufferings endured during differ according to this to the kind of sins that the flame attacks. So the purification takes on a specific individual purification for each soul undergoing the night of the Spirit, depending on the particular sins that must be removed and purified by the flame of divine love. So nobody can tell you what it's going to be like, because for each individual it's different. It depends on the sins that need to be purified, the habits that need to be rooted out, and that is different. Now also, the purification is merged or blended with everyday life. It is a great compliment to St. John of the Cross that he perceived all the trials written in his dark night and was able to put them together in their simple essentials without all the circumstances surrounding them. But we can assume that they do occur in the daily routine of the different individuals whom he directed. The Lord is indeed a supreme master in using other instruments for the purification that he wishes to accomplish in different souls. So he uses persons and things in a marvelous variety, and yet all according to their particular nature. Like the faults of some persons to purify a soul, and the seeming haphazard circumstances of events to carry the soul, try the soul in other ways, the weather, cold, heat, rain, the press of duties, and the many things that must be done all at one time. So it is that God's hidden but purifying action is blended with all the daily events of our life. It would seem that the ideal climate for purification is solitude and the desert. God seems to lead souls into this kind of climate in order to accomplish a great work, for these souls are destined for greater things in God's plan. Remember St. Paul, led into the Arabian desert for 3 years. St. Benedict, founder of the Benedictines also. St. Romuald, founder of the Carthusians, the strictest order within the church and never needed a reform, and they are in constant solitude except for a few hours on Sunday. Charles de Foucault lived and died in the Sahara Desert. St. John of the Cross spent possibly 9 months in solitary confinement in a prison in the monastery of Toledo. When he came out of it, he reached the state of the spiritual marriage. Another reason, the purification is mysterious and often hidden from persons. Because God hides his actions under cover of other instruments, which he uses for the purification of souls, these very souls may not recognize what is happening to them as being God's purification. This may also escape the discernment of others who may want to observe such manifestation of God's action in souls, even spiritual directors. However, this discernment may come more easily to someone who is a contemplative and who has experienced the phenomena of the mystical life rather often. Persons who live an active life and are also contemplatives who are quite involved with external apostolates will find discernment of God's actions in their daily routines and events more difficult because they meet with so many people and there are a great variety of events that occur in their life. God can marvelously use them for his own purpose of purifying them. Yet through it all, everything seems to follow from natural causes. A sickness, financial problems, loss of a job, misunderstandings, disappointments of all kinds, daily frustrations, and many others. Think of the many different persons who might undergo purification. A mother of a family, an executive of a corporation, a teacher, a sports figure, an actor, a nun, a priest, a truck driver, a politician, a banker, a lawyer, a policeman, a bishop, a judge, a farmer, a college student, a doctor, a nurse. Look at all the many vocations. All these persons could be brought to high perfection by the purifying action of God, using the normal routine of their daily events in their respective lives. But with what marvelous variety! The way a nurse or a doctor might be purified for sanctity would not be your way. See? Yet it all seems so normally a part of their lives, but God is using it for their sanctification. So we must not think that God will put a person in a clinically pure spiritual environment, like in the chapel all the time, or in a monastery, surrounded by holy statues and holy water. When he wants to lead them into the dark night of the spirit, he has 1,000 options to choose from, and he uses them all depending on the person being purified. We have saints from all walks of life, a king, a queen, a bishop, sounds like a card game, chess, a priest, a nun, a pope, a housewife, a banker, a general of an army, a single person, some ordinary job like a clerk in a store, a seamstress, a soldier, farmer. Do you know who the farmer, the saint is? Saint Isidore. If the person being purified knew how to use the occasions which God sends for their purification, then their purification might be accomplished more quickly. And then finally, this thought: all is not darkness. There is a light and presence of love. While there is an experience of darkness and confusion many times, yet it is not all darkness. There are glimmers of light given through the extraordinary favors which we mentioned in previous conferences. Then the good God sees to it that the soul has a faint light that seems to be always present, along with an indefinable feeling that God is present in its deepest being. And St. John of the Cross speaks of this in these words: there is an enkindling of spiritual love in the soul, which in the midst of these dark confines feels itself to be keenly and sharply wounded in strong divine love, and to have a certain realization and foretaste of God, although it understands nothing definitely, for the understanding is in darkness. Now remember, we said God's action this time bypasses all that, the understanding, the memory, their feelings, and so forth. But down deep where the Spirit is, that's where he's at work. Now this certainty of the divine presence within is not present to all the faculties of the soul. Yet when a person is tempted to despair, this firm assurance of God's presence within comes to reassure the soul of God's love. This is also true when, on other occasions, there may be doubt expressed by someone about God's action within that soul. They may feel a strong sense of security deep within themselves. This keeps the soul inwardly balanced amid what might well lead to great confusion. So the dark night is a period of suffering, a kind of purgatory, but it's also a time when God deeply wounds the soul with love, bestows peace in the depths of the soul, while the senses may not experience it. Through it all, God is gradually leading the soul to freedom of spirit, healing it of all its emotional and sinful wounds, and transforming it into a love that leads to the highest union with God. Amen. Now we have some time for questions. So who wants to be the first? Perhaps it could be that, but it could be just kind of brain damage that just reduced their intellectual life to that of a child. That's happened in a number of cases. I can recall three instances. I did not mention one of another Jesuit theologian. He was a great writer at the end of the last century, and it was dramatic the way he lost his mind. He was giving a novena. He was in the pulpit. And in the midst of it, he just blanked. And he never preached from that point on. Just walked out of the pulpit, and that was it. Well, that was progressive. That was a progressive, what you call deterioration of brain cells. Yes, you're going to ask a question? Mm-hmm. Well, in some cases, God literally does that. Maybe that's, you might call, it's a final kind of detachment, by the way. If you want to know detachment, to give your own mind and will to God, okay, and then become a child, see? And maybe a final act of humiliation, more so for a great mind like Father Zeberta, Garrigou Lagrange, you know, great minds. But there might have been a residue of pride there that the Lord would say, this got to be purified, so I'm going to take it. I gave you this mind, I will take it. Any other question? Well, it looks like you're all flabbergasted. Well, as I said, I didn't want to go into that too much. But an experience of what that is it's the power again of the soul over the body. In other words, just as stigmata could be produced by an inner stigmata within the spirit, then transferred to the body, so the spirit, when it experiences God's presence, wants to fly to God. And in the strength of its energy, it lifts the body up too. Teresa explaining that says, I felt as light as a feather. And people who have witnessed that say they can move them about just like that. They're so light in the air. One day in the seminary when we were talking about that, we were humorously saying, I suppose John went up there and was saying, what are you doing up there? But Mary Magdalene de Pazzi, the Carmelite mystic of Florence, experienced that regularly. And one day there was a danger of an accident. A statue or a cross was going to fall off the chapel ceiling or something. And she went up and put it in place. And one day she was levitated, and the sisters did not know whether it was God or not. So the sister superior tested it. And she didn't say anything aloud, but mentally she said, if this is of Jesus Christ, but in Jesus Christ's name, I command you to come down. She came down immediately. Proof that it was not Satan. Levitates. Where and who? Father DiOrio. Did others witness it? Who saw it? I'd have to know more about it. Did Father DiOrio see it? Well, I'd like to know more particulars about it. Was she in the chair too? Well, I'd like to know more about it. To me, it seems it's not quite clear. You had your hand up? Bilocation. Well, very few people know what that is, if anybody. And somebody, I forget who it was in the life of Padre Pio, asked him what bilocation meant. And he said, it is a transfer of personality. Transfer means a movement from one place to another, and a movement of what? Personality, not body. Personality would refer to the spirit. So in other words, it would be interesting to know whether the person is active in both places. And it's been found that they're not. In the case of St. Alphonsus Liguori, he was observed to be bilocating. He was in the chapel when it happened, but he was immobile, praying. But he was known to be in the house of a man dying, and he was ministering to him in his last moments. He was active there, but immobile in the chapel. Yes. So they've seen Padre Pio, too. But was he active in both places at the same time? These are things that they're not quite sure of. But these are things, you know, that flabbergast the scientists. They think they've latched on to a lot of things. But when God pulls out his treasure of phenomena, that'll mind-boggle them. We talk about, you know, these flying space belts, you know, lift them up in the air. Well, our saints have been doing that for a long time without space belts. Well, it's God's way of purifying somebody for the infinite love of heaven. They're not to be pitied in the sense of poor souls. They're holy souls. See? They're sure of heaven. It's just a matter of time. We are the poor souls. Pray for us. Yes. You mean like coughing out? Yeah. You know, like somebody that hates life, they've been mistreated, and they said, okay, chuck the world, gonna leave it. Well, they're misfits. Anybody that goes into solitude for holy reasons are not misfits. They go there in order to pray more, to be with God, to be fully open to God's power. Now, God led me into that kind of life for about 9 years in the Alps of Austria. We had a contemplative house. It was semi-hermetical. You had many hours for prayer. We spent at least 7 hours of prayer in the chapel each day. Then you had time to pray if you wanted to. But for 9 years, I was in the active life as a priest for 17 years before that. I loved giving retreats. I taught in high school and college and so forth. So I hope that I could have had an auxiliary career as a concert singer, too. But that's where God stepped in. He said, no way. So he took me out of it and then took me into solitude. And that's where you get to know yourself and to know how God can put you through the ringer. So that was my desert experience. But I consider that one of my blessed moments of all my life. But it wasn't because I hated the world. But I found that the easiest thing was to forget the world there. We didn't even have a phone or a radio in the house. Thank God, no noise. And we were at 4,000 feet, one of the most beautiful areas of Austria. Just like the Sound of Music. Three ranges of the Alps in front of us, 180 degree angle. What glorious sunsets, sunrises in October and spring. Pardon? I conducted the choir in Gregorian chant. I was the cantor too. But no operatic numbers or classical numbers or whatever. None of that. Yes? You'd like to leave your children and your husband, huh? I think everybody here will agree with you. We all have that because there are times when we need to be alone. That's what that's a sign of. But I would say, if you had 2 weeks of that, you'd be saying, oh, I want to get back to my children. I want to get back to my family. Yes. So all of us need times of solitude. Yeah. And we should respect that. A husband and wife should respect each other's need for periods of being alone. Because there are times that God and I are all we need. And that's very precious. But not forever. And not for too long a time either. But we all of us need that in order to kind of get a perspective on ourselves. Where we're going, what's happening to us, and so forth. Well, there's where adjustment must come in. There's where both of them have to dialogue. And I've read about that and how they've worked it out beautifully. And the wife says it's better than ever because now there are things we can do together that we really enjoy that we never did before. But also where he needs to respect her times for what she was committed to already. But it can be worked out just providing he is not too selfish or she is not too selfish. There has to be a compromise. Yes. So when he goes off to work on his hobbies, praise the Lord, huh? Yes, back here. No, I don't think so. Is that recent or? Well, no, I don't know of that, but if you really want to be exposed to the best in Gregorian chant, get records of church music sung by the monks of Salem. They are the world's most famous singers of Gregorian chant. And go to any music store and ask if they have records on chant. Request that, or buy the monks of Mount St. Angel in Oregon. They're Benedictine monks. Well, I'd like to know more definitely whether that's just rumor, legend, or an actual experience. And then it would also come under the heading of ESP, extrasensory perceptions, abilities that the human spirit might have, but what connection might also have with the spirit of evil, who can also insert himself into such activity. That's very complicated, and would have to be tested. It took me 2 hours to say it. Well, I can only say that this period of suffering that the Lord brings in different ways upon us is God's love. Like I said in the beginning, it's like our spirit is this beautiful crystal vase, and